Well, here's your chance to chat with Paul Hynek, the son of the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek, as we talk about UFO cases. We're going to get into a few more UFO stories when we come back and take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Paul Hynek. Paul, when you were a kid, did you have a telescope?
We had an observatory three blocks away.
You had a big telescope.
That's right.
That's fantastic. Now, where can people get the new version of the Hynek UFO Report book?
On Amazon.com.
Okay. It makes it simple for people.
Mm-hmm.
That is just fantastic. I mean, to be growing up in this environment, did you understand what UFOs were when you were younger?
I don't remember a time when I didn't understand what UFOs are.
Exactly. I could see that now. Did your father try to teach you things about that?
It just was part of everyday life. And we asked all kinds of questions because, I don't understand how you cannot be interested in the subject no matter what you believe or don't believe. It's one of the most important questions to face mankind.
Sure.
So, and we were inquisitive, and my dad instilled that sort of scientific curiosity in us, so we were always asking questions.
Was he home a lot, or did he travel a lot?
He traveled more than anybody I've ever known in my life.
Yeah.
Both for the Air Force and just his own speaking engagements and investigating cases all around the world.
And he still kept his University of Chicago situation going, didn't he?
Yeah. So he was, he went to University of Chicago, and he was chairman of the Department of Astronomy at Northwestern for 20 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
He must have loved astronomy. Did he ever talk about what got him into astronomy?
Yes. When he was 6, 7 years old, he had scarlet fever.
Oh, my gosh.
And somebody gave him a book about astronomy. And that lit the fuse in him. And, George, I have that book to this day,
an
actual copy of that book.
What a relic.
That's right.
Keep that for the rest of your life, Paul. Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. All right, let's take some calls. Let's start by going to Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Welcome to the show, Frank.
I'll lead off better. I don't have the speed to be a lead off better. George, I'd like for you and Mr. Hynek to comment on the following. How can we go from the Wright brothers and that rickety plane that they had and in 40 years go to jet fighters, and then President Trump said he wanted to start a space program, which we already have. I don't know if he knows it or not, but we already have it. And he'll take credit for something that he didn't do. But all this relies on what did President Eisenhower know, and when did he know it? Because we have all this anti-gravity
Well, it was probably reversed engineered, Frank, information for us to be able to do that. Don't forget, throw in going to the moon, too, which was pretty dramatic. You ever wonder about that technology, Paul?
You know, I'm a big believer in the singularity, which is the sort of Ray Kurzweil notion that artificial intelligence will become self-aware around the year 2036. And up until that point, technology is increasing exponentially, and it's going faster than we can actually comprehend now. And you mentioned anti-gravity machines. My brother Joel, our friend Hoyt Yeatman, and I are actually working on an anti-gravity machine following the theories of the famed French astrophysicist Claude Poher.
When do you think we'll get full government disclosure about UFOs?
You know, I've come to believe that disclosure no longer means that sort of signal event of a flying saucer landing on the lawn of the White House. Because even if that happened now, what do you think? 20, 30% of people in the world would not believe it? We're just so fractious now. So I think disclosure is not an event, it's a process. And I'm starting to think that it's less what the government will disclose and more what individuals start to believe. And I think when there is a sort of definitive type disclosure, there may be already so many people already aware of the phenomena that it doesn't really matter what the government does anymore.
Yeah, you may be right about that. Next up, we go to first-time caller Sam in Michigan. Welcome to the program. Hi, Sam.
Thank you.
Sure. Hi. Thing. Hi.
Regarding your father's classifications, I have been within 500 feet of at least 4 or 5 extraterrestrial craft. And I've been studying them intensely for a long time. And I can now prove that at least some ET craft are angelic. And you must realize that any beings that much more technologically advanced than we are also more spiritually advanced than we are.
Well, there are a lot of people, Sam, that do subscribe to that theory that these could be other things, very highly spiritual and things like that. That's a possibility, Paul. What do you think?
Absolutely. And, you know, going back to the interdimensional idea, you know, Jim Elvidge in the first half mentioned DMT, which is the most
yes.
powerful psychedelic. I started taking that because that's a strand of my father's research that I'm following, because people report feeling like they've gone to another dimension and they meet what Terrence McKenna called the machine elves, and they see sort of the fabric of the universe being created. So I went there and I asked them, are you what we perceive as UFOs and aliens? And George, the answer I got was, we can't explain in a way that you would understand. And I said, well, I understand no, so it sounds like there's some amount of yes in your answer.
What did your dad think of the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind based on his book?
You know, he was very nervous about it beforehand because Hollywood doesn't always take what we'd call a serious treatment of a phenomena. But he was very gratified with it because it did take a lot of real-life case studies that he reported. And it was a very mature look at a phenomena. And what works of fiction like Close Encounters and now largely Project Blue Book, which is largely fictionalized, do is they really, more than a documentary, widen, open the tent for more people to feel that it's acceptable to believe in something. And they make it less, you know, stigmatized to talk about something. They make people feel more comfortable talking about it. So works of nonfiction can help people understand more, but fictional works have a more sort of emotional resonance to get people over that hump sometimes.
We had Richard Dreyfuss on the program several years ago.
Oh, outstanding.
And he was a perfect part for that movie, wasn't he?
He was. He was like the everyman schlubby character that people could relate to.
Yeah, and he, you know, we had a guest on, David Black, who's a well-known Hollywood writer, and David was talking to us and, you know, mentioning things that, you know, his career and stuff like that. And Dreyfuss was a friend of his.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd call in, and Tommy picked up the phone, and Dreyfuss would say, hi, it's Richard Dreyfuss. I want to talk to David. And Tom said, yeah, right, and then hang up on him. And he called about 3 times. And then David mentioned, oh, by the way, David, Richard Dreyfuss is going to be calling the show. And Tom went, oh, my God. So, but we got him back on. We got him back on.
Good.
What did you think? Did you see the movie Contact?
Yes, I did.
What did you think of that?
You know, that was okay. I felt that the conclusion was a little bit underwhelming for me. And I also come from a position, you know, Carl Sagan, my father, had famous public debates. And they came at the phenomena from very different points of view. One of the interesting things about Carl Sagan, to his credit, is that, you know, to do research on contact, he had a grad student look at time travel. And the grad student came back to him and said, hey, Carl, it's actually more possible than we think. And so that's what sort of opened Carl's mind to get involved with a movie like that.
What other cases did your father just think were just superb?
You know, another one that jumps to mind, and I don't remember if I mentioned this briefly, is Barney and Betty Hill.
Oh, that's a great one. Yeah.
Which was 1961. And for those who don't know, Barney and Betty Hill were an interracial couple in the early 60s. And for them to go public with something that was already out there, but with that racial dynamic, you know, there wasn't much for them to gain personally from doing that.
Right.
And so the amount
Good
of
point.
Personal conviction for them to do that was really compelling for my father. Plus, he met them several times and came to feel that they were genuinely sincere about what they felt they had seen.
When I was 21, one of my other interviews was Dr. Benjamin Simon, their psychiatrist at the time. And I will always remember asking him, if they were telling the truth, what he thought. And he said, as their psychiatrist, as their doctor, I can tell you categorically, they were not lying. I don't know, George, what they saw. They both separately under hypnosis said the same thing. And we all know the story.
Yeah, that's very compelling. And now Kathleen Martin, who is the director of experiencer research from MUFON.
That's right.
She is Betty Hill's niece.
Exactly. And wrote a book with Stanton Friedman
that's
about
right.
this.
And she's a very authoritative figure in the field.
But Simon would go on to say, he said, they are not lying. Whatever they saw, they believe they saw it.
That's right.
And
that's
exactly compelling.
What my father would say. People would ask him, like, hey, did the Pascagoula case actually happen? And it's a case my father investigated very carefully. And my father would say, how the hell should I know? I wasn't there. But I believe they saw that.
Exactly. Next up, Mark in Baltimore, Maryland, east of the Rockies. Thanks, Mark. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my telephone call. I got that book, your father's book, The UFO Experience, at
yes.
a used bookstore. When I went home and I opened it up, it was signed.
Oh, and, super.
And I don't know how many books your father signed, but I never would ever lend that book out. If anybody ever wants to read it, they have to come to my house and read it here.
Under your watchful eye, right?
Exactly. But here's my question. First of all, I agree with everything that you have said. And my question is this. Would you agree that the 5%, like, say, 5% of 1,000, that's 50 unexplained sightings.
Right.
So would you agree that 5%, that's a pretty staggering number considering all the studies that the Center for UFO Studies receives?
Right, and especially given that the Air Force wanted to explain every case, and they weren't really concerned that it would stand the test of scrutiny over time. They wanted an answer right then, right there, and they still couldn't explain 5% of them.
You know, when I tell people about crop formations, Paul, because they say, what if they're all phony except one? And I say, yeah, but it's the one you want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the important thing with UFOs. All of them could be, false. They could be made up. They could be, weather balloons. But if you get that one, that's all you need.
That's right. And with UFOs, 5% is a large amount. There's no field in the world that can ignore 5%.
Absolutely. Did your father ever comment about the UFO cases over missile silos, that they would shut down the silo?
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect. You know, my father called the book that Mark just mentioned UFO Experience. And he did so, I think he was ahead of his time. You know, we used to call people that said they were taken by a flying saucer, abductees. Then we started calling them contactees, and now we call them experiencers. And that's because there's this totality of the experience where they may see something, they may be in contact with an entity, they may go on board a ship, they may see a star map, but there's also like this psychic communication that often is reported to happen both during, sometimes before, and or after the encounter. So it's this totality of an experience. And if you look at that, the same sort of mindset, you look at missile sightings and nuclear power plants, there seems to be something going on there where the sightings that they see have more than just these physical properties they exhibit, but have an intelligence about them and an awareness of what's going on.
Let's get back to the Barney and Betty Hill case, of course. Did your father ever meet them directly?
Absolutely, several times.
And what did he think?
He was very, as you mentioned, as the psychiatrist said, they were very compelling, both individually and together. They didn't seek publicity. They didn't seek to write a book and to make money from the case. They were clearly traumatized. And that's something my father was very empathetic to, because he talked to literally thousands of people who reported UFO experiences. And he came to realize very quickly that the vast majority of people didn't look back at that and say, oh, that was the best day of my life, and start, dancing a jig. No, they were traumatized. And so he knew that that was something that was very common, and that's something he saw with Betty and Barney Hill. And yet the hypnosis, which doesn't always work because you can plant ideas and things like that, but was conducted very well in those cases, just lent that much more credence to two individuals who are already highly credible in my father's mind.
Exactly. Exactly. I remember my mother bringing me home the Look magazine article about
that. Oh, wow.
And I think that might have been 67, somewhere around there. And I was just hooked on that, too. All these great stories. Let's go to Wayne in Tacoma, Washington. Welcome to the program, Wayne. You're on with Paul Hynek.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Paul, I'm really interested in evidence cases, and I'm wondering which of the evidence cases your dad thought were most compelling. And in the photographs that I've seen, the most compelling photograph of a UFO was the 1954 photograph that came out of a United States submarine off of Greenland. I don't know if you've ever seen that or if your dad has ever seen those, but I'm interested in the evidence cases and what you have to say about them.
Yeah, what a great question, Wayne. My father's a scientist, and so evidence cases, as you call them, however the evidence is manifested, are the ones that would be the most interesting for a scientist. Because, my father, I mentioned there are several groups he had to sort of be aware of, and one of them was mainstream science. And mainstream science responds well to evidence. And that can be, like you said, a photograph. It can be some type of physical trace in the ground, a sunburn like on Richard Dreyfuss's face, or it can be multiple witnesses or radar corroboration. And the more of those elements that you have that you can add to a already credible witness, the better you are.
Well, that's true. That is,
and there's so many cases that have evidence. And George, you mentioned the Tic Tac case, 2004. That's one of the best documented cases of all time.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is. When your father passed away, Paul, was he able to talk about more of these cases, or was it a very quick death?
You know, the tragedy of a brain tumor is that it takes away a lot of your ability to think and speak.
Yeah, my sister passed away of the same.
Right, I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah. And so, and I was there. I moved to Phoenix to be with my parents during my father's decline. And there were moments of lucidity, especially when I took him to see Halley's Comet with a month, before he died.
Yeah. My gosh. And 75, that's young. That's the new 50.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah.
It really is. Well, anyways, the name of the book is The Hynek UFO Report. It is a great read, and it was written by Dr. J. Allen Hynek. The new foreword is by Paul and his family with regards to, and this is the interesting thing, Paul, the Project Blue Book cover-up. I like that.
That's right.
He admitted that, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. It was a cover-up not only in the information they didn't release, but in the information they willfully did not collect.
Did it frustrate him that he couldn't get a straight answer out of the government, out of the Air Force?
Yes and no. I mean, it frustrated him that he was involved in an effort that wasn't an honest scientific effort. But he also knew that the Air Force's job is not to advance science. The Air Force's job is to project power in the air, to defend against the projection of power in the air against us, but also to create in the citizenry the perception that they're protecting us against Air Force, forces projected upon us. So the Air Force's job is not to find out what the secrets are unless they're going to reverse engineer them and increase their arsenal, but is to make people, through the organ of Project Blue Book, to make people feel comfortable and not panic-stricken.
We're going to come back and take final phone calls in a moment with Paul Hynek, and some of these questions could be unbelievable. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Paul Hynek with us, our final segment as we're talking about the television program Project Blue Book, the Hynek UFO Report, and his late father, J. Allen Hynek. Fascinating family, Paul. When you all get together for events, Thanksgiving, do you talk about Dad?
Oh, absolutely. He's sort of a larger-than-life figure.
He's an icon.
Yeah.
He really is. Let's go to the phones. East of the Rockies, Glenn's with us in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, guys. Paul, I wanted to let you know I'm a retired newspaper columnist and editor, and now what seems like a lifetime ago, when I was a young reporter, I was an acquaintance of the late John Fuller, who wrote mm-hmm. the
interrupted journey.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. And incident at Exeter. And anyway, it was through John that I was introduced to your father. And the Center for UFO Studies at that time at Northwestern was just getting started. And I ended up writing a press release or two for your dad. And I asked him one day, given all the information, the reams of data, the file cabinets filled with information, how he maintained his enthusiasm for all of the in the face of all that data. And he said something that I'm 73 now, and I've kept this with me all my life. He said, "Glenn, it only takes one. It only takes one case." He was absolutely convinced, I believe, that he would someday find that one case that would be quantifiable scientifically and answerable to all the questions that the scientific community had, and that in one way or another, it would prove the existence of a life that was different from the one we have here. Great to talk to you. Thank you, y'all, for taking my call.
What a small world, Paul,
isn't it?
Thanks
for that recollection. That's really nice to hear. And, you know, maybe he didn't find that one smoking gun, but he certainly set the foundation for others to do so.
Absolutely. Back to the Lonnie Zamora case in Socorro, New Mexico, the police officer.
Mm-hmm.
I still quote that case. It's yeah. One of the best, isn't it?
It is. And that's, you know, by that time, my father had really come full circle and personally investigated that case and thought it was just one of the better, more convincing pieces of evidence in the puzzle.
It sure was. Absolutely. Did he ever meet Lonnie?
Oh, absolutely.
Personally?
Several times, yes.
And he must have believed him.
He did. You know, police officers, by the virtue of their occupation, typically tend to be pretty credible witnesses, and
yes.
He found Lonnie to be especially so.
Absolutely. Same with pilots.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. they have very good vision. They're trained to not get overly emotional when something very strange happens, and they can judge distance and size very well.
Do you believe Project Blue Book died in 1969, or did it continue quietly?
That's a really good question, George. And we've seen recently with ATIP that these projects never really die. They just sort of morph into a different agency. And that one project and sort of that public relations exercise may have gone away,
mm-hmm.
but we know that the Navy and the Army and the Air Force didn't stop studying the phenomena.
And they're probably still studying it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wouldn't you want them to?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Did your father know the late Bud Hopkins?
Oh, absolutely.
He did. Okay.
Yeah, he was a close family friend.
Do we have these giants of ufology anymore, Paul?
Do we have giants of ufology now?
Yeah, like your father. He was one of the giants.
Oh, yeah. Well, Jacques Vallée is absolutely a living legend in the field.
That's right.
And I did I was asked to speak about AI at a UFO conference, and I said, well, I'd be happy to do that, but how about I actually ask the questions to Jacques Vallée, who knows a whole lot more about UFOs and who has a PhD in AI from Northwestern. I think that would be a better experience for the audience.
Perfect. Perfect. Let's go to Janet in Houston, Texas. Hi, Janet. Welcome to the program.
Oh, my goodness. Hello. It's such an honor to talk to you gentlemen. George, I've been waiting a long time to get on the show.
Oh, thank you. By the way, are you coming to our live Houston show? We'll announce it pretty soon.
Oh, my gosh. I will be the first in line.
Perfect.
I promise you. So I'm a retired trauma nurse. And so, you know, I'm really based in a lot of science and, you know, proof of tests. And, you know, did they cause this and this? However, when we were, I was growing up in West Virginia in about 1968, 69, a bunch of the neighborhood kids were playing out on the street. We were playing stickball. And we lived really close to the Pittsburgh airport. So we grew up with planes and, you know, all kind of stuff going across our home. I mean, constantly. And so we knew, you know, those were not UFOs. However, one day we were out there playing and all of a sudden in the sky, just instantaneously, there was this like bright light, some kind of vehicle and covered around with lights. and it just popped up, and it was so bright, and it, you know, maybe was a nova, we don't know. However, we all witnessed these little lights going back into the big ship. And then it was gone.
Wow.
I mean, in seconds, it was gone. But we all witnessed this. And we, to this day, I was born in 55, so I was probably about 13, 14. We talked about it. And then when I was looking up later on in life, looking up that in that time area, like late 60s, 70s, there was noted to be a lot of UFO sightings. And so, Paul, I was wondering, did your dad ever find, like, specific years maybe that were bunched more than others? With certain, you know, UFO sightings or
these flaps, Paul?
Yeah, flaps. That's right. They call them flaps. 1954 was a high water mark for K sightings. 1952 is also notable because, as they show in the show Project Blue Book, in episode 10 of season 1, there were UFOs that went over the nation's capital, Washington D.C.,
captured on a newspaper photographer's film,
right.
Too.
And President Truman actually scrambled fighter jets to go after them.
Of course, that was going to be useless and for naught, right?
Right. But the fact that the sitting president scrambled fighter jets, that means that the reports that bubbled up to him must have been pretty credible.
That was a great series of cases, too. Did your father ever investigate the Battle of Los Angeles, that the story?
You know, I don't know. That's a fascinating local tale here in L.A., and I don't know what he did personally to investigate that, but I want to find out. I want to investigate his investigation of that.
Paul Hynek with us. This is our final segment as we take your phone calls. Let's go to Paul in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Paul, go ahead, sir.
Hello. I'm really glad to get into the show, and really appreciate the show.
Thank you, Paul.
I just thought, Paul, that you'd get a real kick out of the fact that many, many years ago here at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, it was a SAC base, Strategic Air Command, and Major Quantinella was the one that was running Project Blue Book.
Mm-hmm.
And we were out there. We measured a thing in the sky, which we were sure was a UFO. And I called Major Quantinella, and the first thing he said was, oh, no, you just saw Venus. We said, no, it wasn't Venus. We measured the altitude and the speed and so on. He said, what is this, some sort of an engineering program? And yes, it was. We're a bunch of engineering students. I just graduated from the university. And so we were out there on the edge of the runways because we were getting a number of sightings. So, again, I just wanted to get a kick out of the fact that they called everything Venus, no matter what they saw.
Yeah, what a surprise.
Yeah, it was a common thing, you know. No matter what you saw, they said, oh, no, it was just the planet Venus. So,
yeah, you know, and something that's interesting as sort of life or art imitates life is that Michael Mullarky, who plays Captain Quinn, which is sort of an amalgamation of the various Air Force Project Blue Book directors, was born 10 minutes from Dayton, Ohio.
Absolutely. And the ratings, by the way, for the TV show are pretty good, aren't they?
The show was the highest rated scripted show on cable, the highest rated new scripted show on cable last year.
I mean, they're averaging well over 1.5 million people watching it every episode.
Oh, yeah, 3 to 4 million.
It's growing.
Yeah, it's done very well.
That is super. Paul Hynek with us, our final segment here. Let's go next to Harry in Brooklyn, New York. Harry, take it away.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Harry.
I've spoken with you before. I love your show. It's great.
Thank you.
There was a couple of books mentioned on your show a while back called Abduction, about Betty and Barney Hill.
Yep.
And there was the Interrupted Journey.
Yep, by John Fuller.
Right. He was writing about Betty and Barney, right?
That's right.
And also a book, Awakening, by Mary Rodwell.
Mm-hmm.
Are they good books to pick up, to read?
Oh, my gosh, yeah, absolutely. They're classics. If you're into UFOs and ufology, Carrie, those are the ones you definitely want. And, of course, all of Dr. J. Allen Hynek's books, right, Paul?
Of course.
I still love Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I think I still have that original book tucked away somewhere.
Yeah, and the movie really holds up. It's just a really compelling look at the overall UFO experience. And like I talked about, there's more that often goes on besides just seeing some ship in the sky.
Exactly. Clayton's with us, truck driving in Iowa. Hello, Clayton. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for letting me on the show. I'm a big listener. Paul, I have a question. Back in the early 90s, I watched my very first UFO movie. It was directed by Robert Lieberman. The 1993 film Fire in the Sky. I was kind of curious to know, did your father by any chance ever work with the director of that movie or the actor, Travis Walton, who played D.B. Sweeney?
Yeah, so no, but I'm friends with Travis Walton, and I'm talking with Travis about redoing a movie version of his story because he's not altogether pleased with Fire in the Sky.
All right, Travis is a good guy. And by the way, D.B. Sweeney played Travis.
That's right.
And Travis is just a superb individual and passed a lie detector test.
That's right. And that's another one of my father's favorite cases. And Travis and I are friends, and I would love to help him achieve a better version of his extraordinary experience.
He's well received at conferences, Paul. People like him.
Absolutely.
But gosh, I wish we could get him some more real exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take another couple of calls. North Carolina, we go. Ron's with us, east of the Rockies. Hey, Ronald, go ahead, sir.
Good morning, gentlemen. Great program.
Hi.
My name's Coast Guard. I'm 68 years old. I was a radio man aboard Coast Guard Cutter Spencer. And I've had quite a few UFO encounters. Matter of fact, I can remember when I was young, me and my friend would camp out on top of the hill. And if you remember that, the UFO that hit Kicksburg, Pennsylvania, that thing, I'm pretty sure that's when we saw it flew over us and ended up crashing in Kicksburg. But the one I'm going to tell you about is there was this one, I'm going to try to make it in a nutshell because it could be a long story. But,
sure.
But it was, we're aboard the Coast Guard Cutter Spencer. We were on Ocean Station Echo. And the waters were, it was at nighttime, I think it's like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. The waters were perfectly flat. It was like a glass, sheet of glass. And all of a sudden, they piped over the system that, you know, there's, you know, come up on board, there's a, you know, UFO. So out of 140 people, probably about 100 of us, because you have people have to be on station, on duty, all went up and we all saw this, officers and everybody else. I had a friend that was an MST, Marine Science Technician, that had this state-of-the-art Olympus camera, the telephoto lenses and all this stuff. And it was back then, this is 1971, I believe. And I know it was in the summertime. And this, all of a sudden, this UFO, we're looking up, it's just like a bright light. It would go across the sky and it stopped. Then it would dart across the sky and stop, and then it would do like a 90 degree and stop, and then it started to come. You could see it had coming down, and it was like an iridescent type of different colors, and there were portholes on the top, and it looked like, for me, just dots in there. Later on, it turned out with the telephoto lenses, these were beings, I guess, looking down at us, and so we went through all this, and I'm not gonna cut it down to short there, but I was a radio man. I had a clear top secret. So I had to send the encrypted message into Washington D.C. And when we got back into our port was Yankee Pier in Governor's Island, New York. But as we were pulling up, you know, everybody wants to go on Liberty and everything, and if you're three stations, if you're a duty station, if you're not the one on, you get to go. So we're dressed, ready to go. And all of a sudden, I start seeing these three lit black limos pulling up on the
There box. You go.
Never happens. And all of a sudden, there's like six or seven of these men in black. Back then, I didn't even heard of men in black back then. But all of a sudden, these men looked like today, it would be men in black with the hats and golf glasses. I think there were about six or seven of them came up on board, which never, ever happens. And then they told us that you have to go down on the mess deck, which is one deck below where you eat, and you're going to be interrogated. Well, we were interrogated, and they actually came out. And these people I was talking to were like robotic, monotone, no facial expressions. They didn't have the sunglasses on at the time, and they had the hats on. And they're just looking at us, telling us, here, you need to sign this affidavit.
They're trained to be like that. Oh, boy, the show's over. Paul, I want to thank you for being on the program. Appreciate it.
Pleasure, George.
Talk to you soon, and I'll see you at AlienCon soon enough. Paul Hynek. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Greg Bishop, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.